This episode is brought to you by our Supreme Boiler of Leather, Morgan. If you want to find out how to become a Supreme Boiler of Leather and get access to all the bonus content of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. And welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. I am your host, Stefan Sasse, and today I have with me one of our, by now, regular co-hosts.
Hi, this is Jim, commonly called like a lawyer. I write for Wars and Politics of Ice and Fire.
We talked about history and military stuff, and this is something that we will take up today, but tie it a little bit more into the general narrative of things. And I chose as the topic for today, because I think you can contribute a lot of it to it, the fourth novel of the series, which is A Feast for Crows. And thinking about the novels and how you approach them, the title just stuck out to me. You know, it is A Feast for Crows, and we know that it wasn't one of the original big three that Martin chose for his series, you know, A Game of Thrones, A Dance with Dragons, and A Dream of Spring, but rather it was one of those that he had to shove in as the series expanded. And I was thinking, beyond it simply sounding cool, what does A Feast for Crows actually say? Is there a thematic resonance in the whole of the novel? Do the storylines that he separated from the others, A Feast for Crows famously only concentrates on the southern storylines, do they have something in common that ties into the narrative of A Feast for Crows? What is your take on this?
Well, so A Feast for Crows, obviously the imagery is carrion birds. So the collapse of the generals, the power structures in Westeros, with Robb dying, Joffrey dying, Tywin dying, all of these guys are dead, and now the birds are feasting on the corpses that have been left behind. And you see a lot of this with, actually in history, the collapse of strongmen and people that can actually keep the nations in line, and what emerges after. The best parallel, the one that's contemporary, would be the collapse of the Ba'athist regime, Saddam Hussein going out, and then ISIS, which is just straight up a death cult, Takfiri Salafist death cult in Iraq, in the power vacuum. And the obvious parallel to that would be the only other person who is that apocalyptically insane, which would be Euron in the Iron Island.
Yeah, absolutely. What stood out to me about the whole Feast for Crows and Carrion Crows, as you just said it, thing, and the breakdown of order and generals and strongmen, what you talked about, pre-production basically, and to which we'll come back later, is that for me it ties into this statement that George R. R. Martin made that has become pretty famous about Aragorn's agricultural policy. You know, this whole thing about what happens in reality after the last giant battle is waged, you know? Lord of the Rings, for example, it ends after the defeat of Sauron. It's like Aragorn ruled wisely and well for 200 years, yada yada. And now the Lannisters have won, and their narrative could basically stop. You know, if this story was about the Lannisters, if they were heroes, and this would be a traditional fantasy story, you could just stop it here and say, and Queen Cersei ruled wisely and well for another 200 years, you know, things like that. But the story doesn't stop here. In fact, Martin considered this to be only the first act, and the whole second act is basically the cleanup, the fallout, you know, which is an interesting choice for your narrative and has frustrated many, many readers because people aren't accustomed to reading the cleanup operation. And I'm always thinking about George W. Bush on his aircraft carrier, you know, mission accomplished. And if only the story ended there, right? And it is the same for Jamie when he rides around in the Riverlands and in his backpack he has this mission accomplished banner. And there's just no place where he can unfold it, right?
Another big literary parallel that I saw with this, because I'll be honest, I didn't like Feast for Crows when I first read it. I felt that it was aimless and directionless and that it was just sort of meandering and pointless. And it's like, okay, were you just really feeling the writer's block? Which I'm a writer, I sympathize with anyone that has writer's block. But when I read it again and kind of really took it as it was, as its themes, it really came out to me. And the literary parallel I see is the Lost Generation after World War One. And The Sun Also Rises, although my favorite of that is Tender as the Night by, I think it's Eliot, when they say, see that little stream? We could walk to it in 2 minutes. It took the British a month to walking to it, just a little bit at a time, and the Germans falling back a little bit at a time, leaving the corpses behind like a million bloody rugs. It's like no one will ever do this type of war again. This war took religion and years of plenty and the exact relationship between the classes and beer gardens in Westphalia and your father's whiskers and going to the Derby and things like that. And it's talking about all of this lost sense of innocence I wouldn't say innocence, but this lost sense of unity and falling apart and then just realizing you're still alive and there's still, you know, life to live, but what are you going to do? So this lost generation is what I kind of felt as with this book, just in terms of the feeling of being aimless and directionless. You have Jamie trying to figure out who he's supposed to be. You have Brienne trying to grasp to the things that have significance to her in this story, whereas so these protagonists, as in not the insane ones like Euron, they're trying to keep together who they are in this world that has just been completely shattered.
This is an interesting perspective for two reasons. On the first hand, I think we are speaking for many, many readers that our first read-through for Feast for Crows and for Dance with Dragons both has been kind of a letdown, a disappointment. It has to be disappointing coming like 5 years and 11 years after Storm of Swords. And kudos to everyone who didn't feel this, but it takes a while to warm up to. You know, you need to reread. That's the first thing. And the second is that the comparison to The Lost Generation is one that resonates with me as a historian, especially of German history, being a German, you know. Because we had this Lost Generation feeling the Brits at least won the war, right? Because for Germans, this feeling after 1918 was magnified. And then you had these two strands in German politics and society fighting each other through the 1920s about what is the course to go on, right? Is it to move on from it, to learn a big lesson, and to say this can never repeat, and we need to pan-Europa, stuff like that, you know, creating something new from the ashes. And you have the revanchists, the reactionaries, who are trying to take away why it didn't work and do it better the next time. Those guys ultimately won out and recreated the Second World War in history's biggest social experiment, basically, and try to do it better the next time around, and spoiler alert, it didn't work out. But this is always something that comes up when I read things like Euron, you know, who goes in there and who says, last time we didn't dream big enough, you know, we didn't manage to conquer the North. What we should have done is conquer the world. And you're like, what? this is your logic. And then you have Asha, on the other hand, who proposes what isn't necessarily the best option or even a workable option, but it is a different option. You know, it is a whole different idea for what the Ironborn society should be later. And those two visions very briefly clash with each other, because obviously the time frame of the books is pretty compressed. But in the end, the lunatic faction basically wins out with this promise of the big leap, the big gamble, the roll of the dice. You know, we either win it all or lose it all. For some reason, this has a big attraction to people. You know, gambling it all on win or bust, basically. I've never understood where this comes from. But it is attractive for many people.
Well, it's the allure of the actual, the big victory. I mean, you see that in, I mean, casinos have made it a huge business to the point where I think they spend more money every minute than I will ever have in my life. But the idea of grabbing big and winning it all because we are the best ones. We are the chosen anointed few that can actually do it because we're, you know, strong enough, fast enough, smart enough, all of this thing. And I mean, that's been a thing for years and generations. I mean, all of these different identitarian supremacist movements, whether it be race or religion or whatever, they use this impulse too. So to say that it's, you know, I mean, this thing has been common throughout, well, I wouldn't say common. Oh, yeah, common. Yeah, it's been common throughout history. This idea of we are the best and thus we will be able to achieve it. I mean, it's also funny, you hear about Euron talking about, you know, we're going to win big. He never actually mentions anything about losing. And then meanwhile, you have people like Asha who were all in for the Ironborn War when Balon was proposing it. But then they turned out to actually lose a bunch of things. It's one of the things that I find interesting is that there was no peace faction in the Ironborn before the war. What Asha's actually getting is the people who said, look, we bought into this and we got nothing in return. You see her big speech at the Kingsmoot. She says, oh, look, here's the gold of Winterfell. And she pulls up a bunch of yellow turnips on the ground and says, look, that's what all your sons died for. Do you feel big now? Congratulations. This is what we've reaped. We need to change course because what we're doing isn't working. But of course, the problem is that when you have that kind of message, if you take that kind of message, you have to internalize the fact that you tried and didn't succeed. And that is a tough thing for a lot of people to swallow.
Yeah, it's basically this poker fallacy, right? Of throwing good money after bad.
Yeah, yeah. The gambler, well, no, that's not the gambler's fallacy. The sunk cost fallacy.
Ah, right. That was it. People really do not like to cut their losses. And rather choose to soldier on, right? To still try because maybe it might work out. You can't even explain why it should work out, basically. I mean, Victarion really struggles with this in his Kingsmoot speech. When he's called out, what's your actual plan? He's just like, we'll try harder, right? I am offering you the same as my brother offered. And I think this is one of the main reasons why he loses when, phrase it differently, while he comes close to being actually endangered by Asha's proposal, because while she does not command a majority, there is a vocal minority that really calls him out. And this is basically why Euron can take over so easily, because he is offering the sentiment of Asha without the baggage, right?
Oh yeah, no, he's offering the idea of, it's like, listen, if we're gonna have to try again and we may lose, he doesn't actually say that, but everyone's thinking it because they haven't achieved what they wanted to achieve. He's like, if we're gonna at least try, let's go big and try and take everything. Because then we're no longer the greatest Ironborn under House Hoare when they controlled Bear Island and the Riverlands and, you know, the West Coast, basically all of the West Coast feared the sound of the sea and the crack of the oars. It's like, no, we're even better than that because we're going to take the whole damn continent because we can. Of course, you know, the reason why he's able to do this, he actually has some of the arcane power backing him up that he's actually a serious threat. I mean, he's not going to win, but he's a serious threat and there's going to be a lot of an ocean of blood spilled, just as I think it's Mokoro saw the vision of the tide of blood. You know, that's 100% what Euron's going to be doing. And if you've read or heard about the Forsaken chapter, oh boy, I mean,
yes,
he's gearing indeed. He's gearing up. I don't know. That was actually cool because I was actually there when he read the chapter. There was a lot of us there. Aziz and Ishaya, the Radio Westeros crew, we were all there. We were just having a ball.
I can't imagine that. I'm so envious.
When he actually finished, the entire room was just standing ovation for a solid, had to have been 5 minutes. And I'm not trying to overestimate it. You had stamping, you had whistling, you had everything. Everyone was just like, oh my.
Yeah, this is extremely strong stuff. And you can clearly see where this is headed, right? Because Ocean of Blood, this guy is going to unleash a giant ritual in which everyone else is just meat, basically. And yep. You have this over history all the time with those grandiose leaders who are just viewing their followers as the fuel of their big giant dream. And those people are always talking about the great future that will come after the victory. But this is my last question about the Ironborn storyline in A Feast for Crows specifically. Even if they would win, be it Balon's plan, be it Victarion's plan, or Asha's, or Euron's, what do they really have? You know, just imagine the original plan. Balon Greyjoy wants to conquer the North. Great, now he conquered the North. Let's just ignore all the logistics that Asha points out. They have really done it. You, as a average Ironborn, I don't know what they do, farmer or miner or what have you, what did you actually win?
Well, see, that's the thing, is that they believe they're going to get all of these salt wives and thralls, and they're going to go and eat delicious food and raid and all of this other great stuff, and they're not going to have to work a day in their lives. All they're going to have to do is basically, it's like, I need something. All right, let me go get out the axe, and I'm going to get what we need. And it's, they think they're going to get all of this stuff, but, when has that ever worked? I mean, occupation armies are not very good at keeping the populace down if they don't even have the population metrics to support it, and the Ironborn clearly don't. I mean, even in Balon's plan, he sends his most powerful unit, he sends them to Moat Cailin, and then parks it. It's like, great, so you've just now completely pinned down your strongest force, your actual force that can go toe-to-toe with an actual large fleet, like the Dromans or of the Royal Fleet or the Red Wine Fleet or what have you. And it's like, okay. You can take these people. The only reason why Balon's plan even gets anywhere is because Theon actually has local knowledge of how the North works and how it operates and, insider intelligence because he was part of Rob's council a few months ago. So it's like, he doesn't think. That's the thing. Balon Greyjoy is easily the worst strategist and tactician of the War of the Five Kings and possibly the whole darn book, like the whole universe. It's hard to find a guy that's as stupid as Balon, although Halleck Hor might come close. The one that sent three armies against the Bloody Gate to die and got, nothing in return. But, maybe there's a lesson in the fact that most of the Ironborn generals are crap.
Yeah. This is also something that Asha tries to point out, basically, because even if you can occupy the North, even if you can get the cooperation of a populace that you intend to make into thralls and lesser beings, even if all that works out, what you get is turnips, right?
Yeah.
Okay, of course you can eat those turnips, but let's be honest there, you commit yourself to a lifetime of military occupation, of guerrilla warfare and all of that, to gain turnips. Wouldn't it be a little bit easier to plant them yourselves?
Even if you're
the guy digging into earth, that's easier.
Yeah, well, it would be, but that's lesser work for lesser beings. You don't get that warm sense of I'm the better person by planting turnips. You can't really feel like a big man when you're working your hands to the bone, with a plow. You can't feel like the big man. I mean, heck, even raiding south would have been better because at least there's more gold there. But, I mean, even then you have the same problem of you're a hostile power to an entire country that has way more manpower and will want you dead. Because, I mean, what happened every single time the Ironborn tried to do something? It's like, Dalton Greyjoy, beaten. Dagon Greyjoy, beaten. Balon Greyjoy, this is not... It fails every single time just from the population metrics. And there's so many other cool ways they could have gone. I mean, how would it have been like if the Ironborn actually celebrated, you know, the great explorers and shipwrights, kind of the way the Portuguese did? I mean, that would have been an interesting direction to take them. That might even be the direction that they go in the future. But, I mean, this whole idea of we're the best, we're going to raid because, you know, the Ironborn are the best, it hasn't worked. It has such a bad track record of working that it's amazing. But, I mean, I guess in a population where most of them are pre-literate and they can get under the control of these demagogues, basically, I guess that's what you kind of get.
Yeah, I'm not quite – I think this taps basically into a deep – undercurrent of the human experience. I mean, just look at 2015 or 2016. You have over 10 years of failed occupation in Iraq, and still Trump can get support and approval saying we go in there and take their oil, as if this was remotely possible. But it is an attractive proposition. I mean, the German army tried the same thing in World War II. You know, we're going into Ukraine and we take their corn. Yeah, like once, and then it's gone, right? And you can't even take the oil because it's in the ground. You need to extract it, and that doesn't work. But it has, for some reason, even with a very literate populace that really should know better, it has a gigantic appeal for some reason. This we are going in and we are taking the stuff. It is absolutely attractive.
Well, I mean, get-rich-quick schemes have never gone out of style, and that's just the same thing on a national scale.
I mean, it worked for the Romans, but they did it professionally, and the lower classes didn't profit then either.
Yeah, I mean, it worked until it didn't.
And it created no domestic policy problems whatsoever. Talking about occupational forces, let's switch gears to someone who has actually done the conquering that the Ironborn are still only talking about at this point, and look at Jaime, because he is not the conqueror himself, but he now has the command of a conquering army in the Riverlands. By all metrics, they won the war, which Jaime himself acknowledges. You know, everyone tells me House Lannister has won the war, but it doesn't feel like it, you know? And Jaime never really gets a grasp on why it doesn't feel like it. He's trying to personalize it, you know, because my relationship with Cersei is going to pieces. But during his trek through the Riverlands, I think he's coming closer and closer to a kind of epiphany about why exactly it is that this doesn't feel like victory, right?
You have the whole thing where the only reason why the Lannisters won was a severe transgression against one of the most sacredly held taboos. So there's an expression, won the war, lost the peace. And that's really what the victory is of House Lannister. They are completely untrustworthy. No one is going to trust anything that they do, which is why no one, you know, everyone treats the Lannisters, especially the Freys, who actually did the whole thing. I mean, the Tywin was able to kind of keep a plausible deniability of the whole thing, even if he admits to it. But Cersei, they said, listen, you need to punish House Frey for this. And they're like, no, we're just going to let that we'll let Walder Frey die, and then we'll grab a scapegoat. And she's like, yes, this is the best plan ever. And she doesn't realize that everybody hates them for that. And of course, she doesn't care because she's pompous, as is Tywin. But, you know, this peace is a very real thing. The occupation can't last forever. I mean, in American foreign policy standpoint, that's one of the things that they're not really understanding. I mean, I understand the allure. Everybody wants to have the occupation of Japan and the occupation of Germany post-World War II, where they ended up becoming very wealthy and close allies with the United States. I understand that. I personally understand that. But you have to understand why it worked if you want to actually have it happen again. And especially in Iraq, they just didn't have a direction when they were going into it of to how they were going to actually do it. And of course, that was the result.
Yeah, I mean, in both in Germany and in Japan, you had, when the American troops invaded, there were Democrats coming out of their hiding holes with plans for a post-war Germany in hand. This is something you just didn't have in Iraq or in Vietnam or in pretty much any other country, you know. That helps.
Yeah, I mean, and we were able to work with the, I mean, I know there was actually a great story about MacArthur. For all of MacArthur's faults, one of the things that I thought was really fascinating was when, so he was helping build the new Japanese government. And he said, and some people go to him and they say, hey, we have a problem. There's this one lady and she's winning in a district. And he goes, okay. And this, but she was a prostitute. And he goes, how many votes did she get? And that was the end of that discussion. I think he then later said, it's like, oh, she got that many votes, then clearly there's something more to her. But it's like, you know, he actually was able to do that, and that was the result. But, you know, if you can't come in with these ideas of, you know, what are we going to do and how are we going to actually transition to a non-occupation, then it makes sense that you're going to be meandering and muddling and having no idea what's going to happen. And there's going to be hostile actors that are going to take advantage of it, especially the guys that are saying, hey, you know, the strong man has gone. Now it's our turn to be, you know, king for a day.
Yeah, absolutely. Who would the king for a day be in our analogy here in the Riverlands? I mean, it's not the phrase. They're too much in with Jamie at this point. Would you say, like, the Brotherhood Without Banners could devolve into a kind of a tyranny regime? Or?
Well, they already are. They're hanging people without trial. But, I mean, you can also have, I mean, Littlefinger is getting his thing, because now I think he is technically in charge of the Riverlands.
Yeah, very technically.
And then you have, but I mean, you know, all of these regional actors will just end up, I mean, I'm guessing, I mean, what are the Brackens doing? The Brackens are just basically raiding into Raventree lands now, or Blackwood lands at Raventree Hall. Now, I know the Blackwoods are technically still flying the Stark flag, but you can't tell me that they're not going to be just kind of launching depredations against the Blackwood territories because they can.
Yeah, that's true. That's also this Feast for Crows, right? Everyone is trying to pick whatever they can grab from the carcass of what was once the Seven Kingdoms in this analogy. And the peace simply, you can't even say peace, right? The peace only extends to where the Lannister colors fly, and the Lannister colors only fly where they have military to back it up. And wherever the Lannisters are dropping below a certain military threshold, the Greyjoys come out and kill them all. So they need to keep a large force intact and roaming the Riverlands, basically, forever, if they want to keep this region down. Because their only other option is to rely on allies like the Brackens. And Jaime doesn't even make use of the Brackens, right? I mean, it feels justified and kind of cathartic how he treats Jonas Bracken, but it's really stupid from a politics standpoint.
Yeah, and I mean, the other options they have are the Freys. But I mean, even Barbary Dustin says, hey, we lost men at the Red Wedding. The North remembers Frey. If you rely on these actors whose sole virtue is that they're going to work for you, then, you know, don't be surprised when this engenders resentment, especially when they do something like the Red Wedding.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always coming back in my thoughts when I'm thinking about this occupational stuff, etc., to a book I read recently about the Vietnam War. I have to look up the author, but he was basically arguing that America was on the verge of winning in the second half of the war when General Abrams took over, and that basically the politicians ruined it. And he's laying out all those reasons, what worked, you know, how the strategy started to improve. And basically, towards the end of the book, he starts giving a realistic outlook that this would have meant continuing the commitment, the American commitment, on the levels of 1971, 1972 for the next 20 or 30 years. And I was like sitting there, if that is your success, you know, if you are telling me that a democracy or any country to stabilize another country, at least rudimentarily, needs to commit there for 20 or 30 years, this is not going to work. Right, this is simply not a real prospect there, and I think the Lannisters are much in the same position. Their army is already dissolving after half a year. How do they want to keep this up until a new generation of Lannister-friendly lords comes into power? And there isn't even a generation of Lannister-friendly lords. You know, what is the game plan here?
No, I mean, I won't talk about Vietnam. I have my own little things on that, and it's just my thing is you have to get me pretty hammered if I'm going to talk about Vietnam. I mean, it's even worse with the Lannisters, because they're a feudal army, so they have a small time commitment, and then after that you have to kind of basically bribe the levies to stay. You have to bribe their lords, usually with coin, or you have to pay mercenaries and retainers to go and take care of that for you. And this, you know, there's no centralized government. The Lannisters are wealthy. Yes, that's true. But really, you're not going to be able to sustain this. Now, part of the thing with medieval warfare is that, you know, most of the time it's just really a changeover at the top. You know, if they're going to go and oust this king and replace it with that king, the average peasant says, oh, well, I still go to the wine press and I still give them 10th of the wine and so on and so forth. Just please don't kill me. But even then, it's unrealistic given the taboos that the Lannisters broke in the victory, because now they can't say, well, just don't kill me, because how do they know? I mean, if you're going to kill a guest under your house, who aren't you going to kill? It's kind of the same thing with the Mad King, with the Robert's Rebellion, where they say, okay, hey, your son messed up. Come on down here and ransom. Oh, haha, everybody gets burned to death. It's like, oh, well, now what do we do? We can't anticipate, you know, justice from on high, because he's just going to murder us for no real reason. I mean, heck, it's, even loyal servants might think, well, hey, I was loyal now, but, you know, he could just say, oh, I don't like the color of your vest, and to the pyre you go. And then what are you going to do? I mean, it's a recipe for permanent hostility, because there's no actual faith in the actual government. So if there's no faith in the government, then the government isn't going to be able to keep the order unless they actually do it militarily, and that's unsustainable in the long term, just because of the troop commitment, or the resource commitment, I would say, because it's more than just troops.
Before we go on, let me get in a brief word by our sponsors, which is, of course, you, the listeners. I want to do a little advertisement here for the Boiled Leather Audio Hour Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour, you can pledge money to this podcast to keep the lights on and keep this podcast going. And in return, of course, you are getting bonus content. So you can get, for $1 a month, you get access to exclusive essays that I write. At $2 a month, you can get little podcast versions of these essays, so you can listen to them on the go. At $3 a month, you get the show notes for the Boiled Leather Audio Hour itself. At $5 a month, you get access to the Boiled Leather Audio Moment, which answers questions of anyone pledging $5 a month or more, which is usually with the co-hosts. At $10 a month, you get access to our new bonus podcast, which is the Boiled Leather Audio Conversation, in which I have in-depth discussions that didn't make it into the final podcast, or that simply didn't fit with the topic into the final podcast, and where we are discussing those. It's usually a little bit more on the geekery side of things. And at $20 a month, you get to be a Supreme Boil of Leather, which of course gets you mentioned right in the beginning of the episode as the brought to you piece. So if this isn't enough for you, please check out Boil Leather Audio Hour on Patreon. That's patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour, and try to give it a go. It is a real help and keeps this podcast going. And with that little interruption, back to our regular program. Thank you very much. I'm not taking any more of your time. Yeah, you need dragons for that, right?
Well,
That helps a lot. But even the dragons, if we take them as gunship replacements, it still really doesn't work, right? And the last part about Jaime that I and the Riverlands that I have to make here is about the question of holding Riverrun. Because I have written, it's years ago now, it's a really old essay of mine, in which I argued that the Blackfish really wasn't justified in holding Riverrun, because he has no chance of winning. There is nothing to be gained. He is under siege. There are no friends coming. He's surrounded by enemies. So holding out is serving no goal. And since he scoured the landscape clean, he condemned basically a lot of peasants to die. But I have since been brought around at least a little bit by Stephen Attable mostly, because he has argued convincingly, I have to add, that what you just said as well, that you cannot trust the word of the Lannisters. So if Jaime tells him, you can go to the wall, and everyone else is free to go, he has to basically assume that all the peasants in the surrounding area are already murdered and that everyone will be killed the moment he opens the gates. So I can see the reasoning for this a little bit clearer now.
Oh yeah, I mean it's just that's the thing. If you can't trust them to deal with you fairly, then you just can't you can't transition away from war to peace. I mean that was one of the big things with the Dance of the Dragons. Neither Rhaenyra, I know I keep saying Rhaenyra and everybody keeps yelling at me, but or Aegon the Second, they don't offer credible terms of peace. And so it's like, well, I'm probably going to get killed either way, so I might as well go down swinging.
This is also how wars tend to end. When the cost of actually giving up seems less than fighting on, armies break. Neil Ferguson has made a great argument about this in his book A Pity of War, about the First World War, in which he showed that that in summer 1918 the German soldiers started to yield en masse. Throughout a whole World War I, you had relatively little numbers of prisoners of war, and suddenly, starting summer 1918, you get hundreds of thousands of prisoners, and this is basically where the German army starts to dissolve. This moment never comes in certain conflicts. The Riverlanders, they don't start yielding to the Lannisters per se. The Lannister army shows up, and they are forced to kneel for the moment. But it is pretty clear that this is a for the moment. The moment in which everyone runs over with flying colors, like after Robert's Rebellion, when most houses left the Targaryen side and went over to Robert. That never happened with the War of the Five Kings.
Yeah, and you see why it happened, because Robert habitually said, all right, if you join me, I'm not even going to take a hostage. If you join me, I'm going to keep you in. Now, obviously, that didn't happen with the Targaryens, because Robert went completely mental when it came to the Targaryens. But even then, he got talked down by Jon Arryn when he said, look, Viserys and Daenerys, they're in Braavos. They're no threat. Let's not worry about it. And eventually he's like, okay, let's not worry about it. So even then, Robert's kind of magnanimity, I said that wrong, magnanimity. I'm probably saying that wrong. Oh, well, whatever.
Your excuse.
The generosity he showed in bringing people over to his side, to the point where it's like at Summerhall, he beats three armies and then immediately brings them into his service, to the point where in the very next battle, one of the lords dies for Robert. That's pretty exceptional, and it shows to how you can actually win people over. I mean, of course, part of that is also because Aerys was murdering people for no reason at all, so the comparison is very clear. It's a little harder when it gets into more nebulous thing, when you actually have, for the most part, rational actors actually in a war.
Yeah, but a lot of people still hold true to the Targaryens because I guess they don't feel that Aerys' wrath is targeting them, at least not yet. I mean, many houses remain committed to the Targaryen cause for, let's call it, ideological reasons. And this is, of course, one of the weaknesses of Robert's reign, and that the Lannisters, when they come in power, share as well. There is no ideology that props up their monarchy other than I am the monarch and you swore an oath to me, you know. The Targaryens had this whole exceptionalism thing going and 300 years of tradition and whatnot. And you can, I think, currently see the breakdown of the whole idea of a monarch ruling over the Seven Kingdoms, because it becomes increasingly clear that you, A, don't really need one, and B, the ones you got make things worse, which is a dangerous time for any political system.
Well, so it's actually interesting in Robert's Rebellion in that the two major regions that fight for the Targaryens actually have pretty good reasons to do so. The Tyrells in the Reach specifically owe their overlordship of the Reach to the Targaryens. So Aegon I raised up Harlan Tyrell as the overlord of the Reach over all of the other claimants with better claims. So they derive their legitimacy through the Targaryens. And then the Martells, of course, that's because of marriage and in-laws and also hostages. So their loyalty is kind of begrudging loyalty, I might add. That's been on record by Martin. So you can kind of see why they actually went for it, even if when you kind of think about it, you're like, well, you know, also the very real erratic rulership you might fear just losing it just in general, but it's good enough. It's good enough. I used to be pretty hard on Robert's Rebellion for the fact that it's like really nobody should be fighting for the Targaryens, with the exception of the diehards. But there's enough reasons that you can kind of see the decision-making, even if it isn't a very smart decision. That's one of the things I need to get better at in my world building, is that I need to be able to properly map out bad decisions.
If they are even bad decisions, you know, as you just said, I mean, it worked out for the Tyrells, right? But there was a very clear danger that if Robert's Rebellion won, that the Tyrells would not come out on top, even if they joined, you know?
That's true. That's true. They might have, he might have just said, well, you know, you no longer have the legitimacy of Aegon backing you, so you're no longer the overlord. I might have a great council a Reach council to decide the blood claim, or I might just give it to somebody who gives me the better deal. That is entirely possible.
But speaking of all the rulers on the King's Landing level, let's move our Feast for Crows focus back to King's Landing as well. Because I think what you can see here is what I just mentioned, you know, this dissolution of government, of authority, of legitimacy, because I think you can, even though in the Riverlands or the Crownlands where Brienne is on the road, and we will come to her, or where we can see Jaime going around and you have Euron claiming that all of Westeros is dying, nowhere are the crows so obvious at work, at pecking at the corpse of Westeros, as they are in King's Landing. And I mean, they are basically eating up the remnants of the old order. When Eddard came to King's Landing in Game of Thrones, he was always like, okay, they are flatterers and fools, and I need to find them out. But there were good people in King's Landing as well. And there was a city that was very much corrupted, but that was still functioning in a way. And you don't get that impression of the King's Landing of A Feast for Crows. What we have here is basically a government that's totally in the process of breaking down. And nowhere can you see this better than with all the sycophants and third raters that are in power here. And that fucking Pycelle is the clever one. One of the worst counselors in Game of Thrones and Clash of Kings and Storm of Swords, who gets thrown into the Black Cells and almost forgotten until Cersei pulls him out to score cheap points against Tyrion. He is basically the voice of reason and the most competent guy in government.
Well, it's funny because the only reason why these guys were able to get into power was sucking up to the actual strongmen, and now the strongmen are gone, so they're the ones that are left. This is actually a lot of things that happen in history when a revolutionary dictator gets into power and then dies, and then you're left with the people that he specifically handpicked because they were loyal and not competent enough to actually pose a threat to him. And these are the guys that are left. And they have to go and run the country that they never had to do because it was a cult of personality doing the whole thing. And now the personality is, 6 feet under.
That's absolutely a problem. And I mean, even in this case, you have the personality 6 feet under. Robert is dead, and Joffrey, who at least projected some force. I mean, it was a very bad Aerys-like force, but it was some force. You could, if you were a Lannister toady, you could get behind Joffrey and feel reasonably safe. But now you have a child king who likes to stamp his seal on stuff, and he is controlled by Cersei, who, for one, is a woman, which is, in a misogynistic society, always a huge problem, and she is engaging in a giant refusal to do any constructive policy work. You know, she has inherited 7 kingdoms that are ravaged by war, that are in desperate need of some build-up. And she not only... It would be excusable if she just botched it, you know, but she refuses to even do it. And adds on and piles on harm instead, you know, like sending Jaime to the Riverlands to press the thumb down even more, trying to get the Vale into the fold with brute force, trying to antagonize the Dornish for some reason, starting a war with the Tyrells. It is the Iron Bank of Braavos. It's all a clusterfuck of epic proportions. And... Or think of the Red Wine Fleet. It is always, everything she does is just piling on the harm and creating more fodder for the crows.
Yeah, well, so the clear parallel to this is Aerys the First, when the Great Spring Sickness ravages Westeros, and then Dagon Greyjoy comes out of the West. But Aerys and Bloodraven are still looking at the East going, I know the Blackfyre is going to try something. And meanwhile... The Westeros is suffering. They're in the middle of drought. They're in the middle of war, and the guys at the top do nothing. And that's when Sir Kyle the Cat says, at least the Starks and the Lannisters fight. At least they're trying to do something. And it's like, even a failure. I mean, a failure would have its own political problems, especially in a government system like feudalism, but a failure is better than nothing at all. I think there's an old saying, which is, if something is worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. Which is, it's like, even if you only exercise for 15 minutes because, you're worn out and tired, it's better than doing nothing at all. And so that's, I think, the sentiment with Cersei, where she just says, she consolidates political power within Lannisters. So not even going out to Lannister allies to give them positions. And any position she gives out to an ally, like the Reachman, she does so grudgingly and then undercuts it by then engaging in a private war with them. So she's just, it's a recipe for disaster. But I'll say that I don't think Joffrey actually could have been someone that they rallied behind. The Lannisters were rallying behind the fact that if Tywin wanted to, Tywin would just grind Joffrey into the dirt and make him do what Tywin wanted. And so it's that legacy of Tywin that really was what the Lannisters were going after. I think it was Emmett Booth that, poor Quentin, for those who don't know, who said like the legacy of Feast for Crows is the differing legacies of Ned and Tywin, where, the Lannisters are falling apart before Tywin's corpse is cold. Meanwhile, you have the northern clans who say, I'm going to go and march through a raging blizzard for the Ned's daughter. That, I think, is the big legacy. The crows feast on Tywin. But even though Eddard is dead, the crows aren't feasting on him. The people are taking the memory of Eddard with them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You need to look at the whole of Feast Dance for it, not just a Feast for Crows, because obviously the northern counterpart comes only in A Dance with Dragons. But you are definitely right, and Emmett has made a great point about this. I think this this whole managing the peace thing is incredibly prominent in both of the books, but we get a lot of more workable solutions in A Dance with Dragons, where in A Feast for Crows we see mostly exactly that. You know, the feasting that is going everywhere. And I didn't want to kind of propose that Joffrey would have in any way been an efficient ruler, but it would have been possible at least to keep up the regime based on its strength-based approach, whereas with Tommen and Cersei, this clearly isn't workable.
No, that is true. But I mean, Joffrey was a bully, and I think everybody kind of knew he was a bully, especially when he was condemning the people that fought for Stannis, and he slams his hand down and cuts himself on the Iron Throne and then says, "Mother!" It's like, well, I mean, you can't have a projection of strength with a ruler like that.
No, absolutely not. But bullies, you can work with bullies. You know, Joffrey is a bully and he is cruel and everything, but he is kind of, you can calculate him. You know what you can say and what you can say and how you have to handle him. I mean, he's a rube, basically. You can always manipulate a bully in ways which you cannot manipulate a madman like Aerys or a woman like Cersei. I mean, obviously, you can manipulate Cersei. Her whole arc in Feast for Crows is nothing but manipulation. But you cannot manipulate her in the way that kings are usually manipulated by their stronger vassals and counselors and stuff.
Yeah, well, it's also, I mean, you can manipulate Tommen rather easily. I mean, he's 8. But the problem is that even if you manipulate him to do something, someone else can just manipulate him to do something else.
Yes.
So that predictability is gone.
Exactly.
And I can definitely see how the predictability is a significant factor.
And that's what I mean. Joffrey is bad, but he is predictably bad. And this goes a long way, actually. I think this is also something that draws the Reswells and other houses of the North to grudgingly support the Boltons. You kind of know where you stand with Roose Bolton, you know? It's not a comfortable place to be, but you know what you have to do so that he doesn't skin you. And this is something that's not true of Ramsay, for example, or the Freys.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Yeah, because I mean, when you again, going back to the Red Wedding, if you can be murdered at after taking the present salt, you know, what can't happen to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is also something that Cersei never understands. She sees all those rituals, the rules, the norms. She sees them as obstacles or trappings or something that's only for fools. But I think a lot of this is why she underestimates the threat from the religious fanatics so much. Because she's always on this, religion, it's just opium for the masses, you know, it's just for fools. And since I'm not a fool, I can totally control it, because only fools fall for religion. And from that hubris stems her fateful decision to throw religious extremism onto this pile, basically, this pile of corpses that has been produced in Storm of Swords. And I'm not quite sure if I would see the religious fanatics as the crows, or if they just make more fodder. I'm not quite certain how they fit into the metaphor. But their ascent definitely factors into it. I get a little bit of an ISIS vibe from them, you know. There has been a ravaging war, occupation has gone bad, and now you have on top religious fanatics with weapons.
Well, that is true throughout history. When authoritarian strongmen fall down, other strongmen look to replace them. And usually religion ends up being one of the movements that a lot of people use. There's a great book I've read called The True Believer by Eric Hoffer, and he goes into the similarities between a lot of that. He was actually a longshoreman that was he went blind when he was a kid, but then got it back. And because he got it back, he was so nervous about going blind again that he read every chance he could get. And it was a book that was so popular that Eisenhower actually gave it to a lot of staff when he was talking about fanaticism, whether it was communism or other movements in, it was the Cold War, so communism was the big one in Southeast Asia and Africa and places like that. But I mean, you know, there was a lot of movement, religious movements after the collapse of the colonial empires as well. Even during the colonial empires, there was sometimes you had to deal with religions, especially when the colonizers' religion and the colonies' religion were different, whether it be Christianity and Islam or Protestantism and Hinduism in India.
By now, we have talked mostly about the decision makers on the top, you know, the chief crows, so to speak. But of course, there is always, you have what happens on the top level, you have a reproduction on the small, on a micro level, 100 and 1,000-fold. And our POV on this, our moving cameras, so to speak, is Brienne, of course. One of these storylines that most people on first read find the most frustrating one and one of the most rewarding when they come back. And like Arya in A Clash of Kings, Brienne is basically used to show us that the effect of war, you know, the consequences that the war has. And she herself witnesses kind of the dying, the metaphorical dying of the songs, you know, because you see a lot of people who are acting counter to the social expectations that are put upon them. You have Randall Tarley, who should hand out justice because he is a lord and he brings back order to a ravaged region, but instead he is just building up this, I don't even know how to call it, this judicial tyranny that he has going. You have people like Heil Hunt who feed into the larger leitmotif of the nightly vows being ignored and all that kind of stuff. But she herself is reinforcing them at the same time, which I find an interesting contrast. And while we were just talking about religious fanatics, of course she meets a religious fanatic of her own, which is Septon Maribald, who is basically the positive side of religious fervor, you know, using it for good, right?
Yeah. One of the big things that religion does is it provides comfort to people, and that is what he does. He goes and says, you know, yes, broken men are broken men, but this is why they're broken, and we need to have empathy for them, and we need to be able to, you know, I mean, don't let them get away with, you know, ravaging the people, but understand this is what happens, and now we need to come and try and find a solution to that. But then you have, one of the nice things I like about Brienne is Brienne's devastation. She sees the devastation externally, but there's all kind of devastation internally, where she has to try and maintain her high standards in a world that is openly mocking them. And that's been a theme with in the story. Sansa's chapters have a lot of that sentiment, where Sansa's trying to handle the cynicism of Cersei and Littlefinger without compromising her true sense of self, her compassionate ideals. But with Brienne is saying, you know, no chance and no choice. And that's saying that, yes, I know that this world is not living up to the values that it prescribes of its people, but the values have meaning and I'm going to do them. And that's Brienne's struggle, is to continually do that. I think she does so very well. One of the best scenes I like is when she's over in when Nimble Dick Crab dies, and she tosses the coins into the grave, saying, you know, I'm sorry that I didn't trust you, and I'm going to pay you what you're owed. That's in my appraisal, that scene is ultimately the proof that the book series is a romantic series. It's not a cynical, realistic series, because that wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have been held up as a moment of good for Brienne to do that, because it in no way helps her. I mean, she's losing money, which, I mean, you could always just use more money, especially when she's on a quest for bribes or for paying for information or what have you. But she says, you know, no, Nimble Dick Crab did right by me. I need to do right by him. And I'm sorry that I let the cynicism, the world weariness of this get the better of me and, you know, treat you ill because of it. So I think that's Brienne's small victory. And I think when you go through Brienne's read the first time and you're like, she's not going to win, you know, this entire excursion is pointless. And if you go into it from that sentiment, then Brienne's chapters are just dull, you know, waste of pages. But when you go in and look at the small victories that she's achieving internally, I think that's when Brienne's arc in A Feast for Crows really popped for me.
People who still don't get that the Song of Ice and Fire is not nihilistic, I can't help those people. I mean, they're reading fundamentally different books than I am, basically. So I want to subscribe to everything you just said. And one of the things, if you look at how Brienne's arc in A Feast for Crows is coming to its close, we get to the Inn at the Crossroads, which is obviously a very seminal place in the saga. And it is occupied by orphans, right? And it is run by children. And the oldest one of them is Gendry. It has a little bit of a Peter Pan vibe to it. The lost children who made their own thing, but of course with the more realistic touch that Martin always provides. And this is also at the same time horrifying because you have those starving lost orphans, but at the same time it's also hopeful because these children are managing for themselves and they have friends in the Brotherhood. And this is the last point for Brienne's arc. What we can see is this degeneration, this falling apart of the Brotherhood without Banners. They started out basically as Robin Hood and the Merry Men. And now yep. They are serving a vengeance zombie. And they are basically the bad fans having taken over. You know, all of this is meaningless. All of it is dark. And we have to... we have to use force because all those values don't hold anymore. All of that, you know? And I think it is pretty clear in that they are made the antagonists of Brienne's arc after all the internal victories that she won. That this is a false reading, that this degeneration is always bad. It is understandable, of course, in their case. But the Brotherhood has degenerated into crows that are just indiscriminately killing and ravaging the countryside also. I mean, they are still helping others like the orphans, but they're much more discriminate in who they help compared to their incarnation when they were still led by Beric Dondarrion in Storm of Swords.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's one of the central themes of the whole novel is when the chips are down, are you going to maintain these ideals or are you going to just make a compromise here, a compromise there, a compromise here? And I mean, it's not saying that all compromises are bad. I mean, you have to everyone has to make compromises with reality. That's just the nature of the beast. You know, I think it was a quote I heard once. It's like when ideals meet reality, it's rarely reality that backs down. But what are you going to do? And you have Brienne, you have Sansa. These people are confronted with this, but they keep true to themselves and they keep true to the ideals that they hold. And that's what makes them stronger characters overall. Whereas the Brotherhood without Banners embrace the easy path, or the Ironborn embrace the easy path, the get rich quick scheme. All of these guys, they embrace the easy road because they think it's going to maximize their own gain. And is it, you know, the kind of the lesson, which is the romantic lesson, is that really those gains are hollow and you've gained nothing compared to what you've lost.
Of course, holding to your ideals is always only then an admirable thing if your ideals are actually worthwhile, right? Because, I mean, Hitler held to his ideals as well, and we don't exactly celebrate the guy. And one of the things where we are in a very gray area regarding ideals and keeping to them and remaining true to an idea above everything else is in Braavos with Arya and the Faceless Man, where she's basically training to become Batman, right? And I'm unsure as to how she ties into the larger narrative. I'm always a little bit tempted to put her down as basically an extended training montage. She has an arc, of course, and these are really great chapters, and they do a lot of character work. But Arya and Braavos in A Feast for Crows seems a little bit disconnected, at least at times, from the general plot and what is going on in the rest of the books. And I mean, she has two. She not two. She has one major encounter with the rest of the plot when she kills Darian, because he is an example that ties back into Jon's arc from Dance with Dragons, and he is the dying of the Night's Watch as an institution. And if we're doing an episode like this about Dance with Dragons, this will become a major theme. Here in A Feast for Crows, it is just on the margins. We can say that as institutions as old and full of tradition as the Night's Watch is, can also break down when people stop believing in them and do approach all of their vows and traditions and way of life with just cynicism. And on the other hand, Arya has joined an organization that is extremely rigid, that is extremist. I think you can't put it any other way, about their ideology, and that demands total dissolving of the self in order to become a member. I mean, in some ways, Arya is training to become a terrorist, right?
Yeah, well, so I think one of the interesting things is I think what's actually going to lead her back is, again, this legacy of Ned Stark. The Arya has very clearly executed the Night's Watch deserter for being a Night's Watch deserter, which is one of the first things we see Eddard Stark doing. So I think the core sense of self is and will end up not being lost because of her ties to the Stark. She's not going to give up that piece of her identity. And I think that's another feather in the cap for the legacy of Ned Stark, or for the Ned Stark way of doing things.
Absolutely agreed.
I understand. I know I got frustrated with her arc, as well as with Bronn later, because it's like, all right, I know you're not actually going to interact with the plot yet. I know you are going to interact with the plot later, but you aren't doing it yet. And it's that failed achievement of the of bringing it back makes me does frustrate me a little, but I mean I just have to have faith that the plot is going to come back to where it's going to come back to, and Arya and Bronn are central characters, and they're not just going to jump off of the plot in the second book and never come back.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, of course. What do you think of Sam in Braavos? He's there for one or two chapters, I'm not entirely sure at the moment, but he is witnessing the dying of Aemon, and I think his passing is played in this prolonged and prominent faction in the book for an important reason. Because in a book in which we have a lot of people, a lot of things, about a lot of institutions and traditions, etc., dying, to lose someone who is 102 years old and who has been the heart and the memory of the Night's Watch has just a strong thematic resonance, I think. And they are trying to preserve him and his body later, and they have the books with them, and all of that goes into trying to preserve things throughout this Feast for Crows, for the time after, for the rebuilding phase. Would you agree with that assessment?
So I think the big thing with Sam, I mean, it's the loss that Sam has that anchors him. I mean, no, when Maester Aemon is kind of been the heart and the anchor for a lot of the Night's Watch characters, being Jon and Sam, and I think the loss of it is kind of the loss of the mentor, where Sam has to stand up on his own. But I mean, yeah, I can see the kind of the death of the institution. And the crows feasting on it. I mean, you saw a little bit of that in with the death of Jorah Mormont and or not Jorah, Jorah Mormont, and then the taking over of the Night's Watch by this young boy Jon Snow, and then his reforms including bringing the wildlings over and staffing the new castles, is completely radically different from the old order, which, I mean, some of the traditions that the Night Watch did do were, you know, frankly, they were bad choices. I mean, Alistair Thorne was terrible when it came to being a drill sergeant, essentially. The good lesson I give, this is a story from my own experience in the military. There was one guy that was messing up, and we were kind of giving him a hard time about that, and our sergeant overheard. And so immediately we were doing push-ups, and then he had to go, the guy that we were yelling at, he had to go into the back and then one by one evacuate every single one of us from the from doing push-ups. And then finally he just sat us down and says, "When I do it to make you better. You were doing it to feel better about yourselves." And that was what Alistair Thorne was doing. Alistair Thorne was reveling in the power he had over the recruits, to the point where it's like it was actually interfering with their training. And the only reason why he actually even got the job, as Gior says, "Well, he's one of the few knights that I have." It's like, so? At this point, you need to have effective soldiers who fight as a unit. You don't need a guy with the highest pedigree doing that. That's why NCOs are the ones that take care of the training in basic training. They're sergeants. They're not lieutenants or captains.
Yeah, those are very good points. I'm always amazed at the complexities of the Night's Watch and how their wrong traditions, you know, keep them from doing their actual job, while they're at the same time having this ideology of, oh, everyone can make it in the Night's Watch, but really only if you are an anointed knight, because we have to have standards. This has always been a great, paradox of sorts. So with that, I would leave Old Town, and I have three regions left that we didn't talk about yet and that play a role in A Feast for Crows, and all of them are not touched by the war yet. And I think the key word here is yet, because it is heavily foreshadowed throughout the whole story that they will soon join the Feast for Crows, not in the novel that bears his name, and obviously not in the next one, but in The Winds of Winter, all of them will pay a heavy toll in lives. And this is, on the one hand, Old Town, where we have Pate and later on Sam arriving, and which will be ravaged by Euron Crowseye. And I have to say, if I look at the whole of A Feast for Crows, it's not entirely clear why Old Town becomes the center of the plot until you read The Forsaken, you know, and it becomes immediately clear as to what will happen there, with a really giant apocalyptical event that will take it down. And then you have, of course, the Vale, which has been kept out of the war by Littlefinger, and he is sitting on a corpse heap that he created himself, and he plans definitely on making it higher. And the last region is Dorne. And Dorne is, of course, everything but a peaceful hub of tranquility, right? So there is a simmering tension below the atmosphere, below this Feast for Crows. They could take flight at any minute, and the hostilities will take up again.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting to see with Old Town. Old Town is one of the last hubs that could be used as a means to rally around, which means, of course, it's doomed. That's going to be the case with Old Town, because they, you know, it's a repository for knowledge, and as we've seen, none of these institutions are being spared from the fires to come. So obviously, for plot reasons, if nothing else, Old Town has to go away. The Vale is kind of interesting because, they're a strong region, and Sansa is there, which is, so it's going to be this upcoming struggle between Littlefinger and Sansa, which my current theory is that she's going to manipulate Littlefinger into implicating himself or incriminating himself in front of a hidden Bronzeon Royce, and use that to take control of the Vale, and to do that in order to get you know, and I think that's going to put the Vale on track for the apocalypse in the north, because the Vale's got to take their lumps. They're not going to be spared from this apocalypse any more than anybody else is. And Dorne is funny because the wounds are entirely self-inflicted by Doran. I mean, Arianne does her own thing, because Doran is like, well, let's keep her ready so that I can launch my plan, but I'm not going to bring her in because I'm paranoid of this, and I'm the super architect, spy master, plotter supreme. And as it turns out, his secrecy and his ability that I have this plot, and it's such a great plot, is what ends up sinking his plot by having Arianne do her own plot that just throws a monkey wrench into the plots of Doran.
And all of this is really well done in thematic terms. You know, in Dorne, you have the water gardens and Doran's fear of the children. You know, I must protect children. No harm can come to the children. And I mean, poor children, but you're really doomed. And in the Vale, you have this constant mentioning of how fertile it is, how much food they have, how Littlefinger is stockpiling even more food. And in Old Town, of course, you have this lush area of knowing. And all of these three areas are so destined to go down. I mean, this is, I guess, one of the major reasons as to why A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons ballooned so much. This Feast for Crows had to be created by Martin in order to take everybody from the board for the White Walker apocalypse. If any army would have been left in the field, he would have been faced with logical issues. You know, there cannot be any center of resistance that naturally brings itself to the fore. I think this is also one of the reasons why, for example, in The Walking Dead, they go out of the way early on to establish that the Center for Disease Control is dead. You know, just to get this out of the way. There is no one is coming. You know, and Martin is of course doing this just a little bit better than The Walking Dead, and by that I mean like lots. Lots of better, and he is creating this Feast for Crows also to really remove player by player by player from the board. And so the armies, the yet intact armies of the Vale, of Dorne, of the Tyrells, and of the Greyjoys, they all need to go. And we see this partially happen within the book, and we see the seeds of it laying down in this book, which is why The Feast for Crows is at the same time descriptive as well as a prophecy of things to come, a prediction.
Yeah, well, it's going to get worse before it gets better, if nothing else, because the Ice Fairies and their zombie armies haven't even shown up yet. You know, I think there's also one of the themes of, you know, are you going to stay true to your ideals is the case with these regions, because the Hightowers are supposed to be lords and thus, you know, defending the people. But they're holed up in the Hightower consuming esoteric lore. I mean, it would be really cool for a magician face off between Mad Melora Hightower and Euron Greyjoy. But that's probably not going to happen. I think that's a little too high fantasy for the book. And then you have the Vale, where these, you know, Littlefinger is specifically using the fact that the Vale is going to send out their largesse of grain to others because of that whole noblesse oblige, and then take advantage of it and make them weak, and then actually overtly accept his authority when they're hungry and he's the one with all the grain. And then you have Dorne with this. I mean, this is more A Dance with Dragons, but when the blood orange falls and he says, you know, the time for it's long past, he's looking at the children of the water gardens, and eventually, you know, he's there deciding, do I want to have compassion for the children or do I want my revenge? And he picks the revenge. And so Doran falls to the same depredations of these other, you know, antagonists, or just, you know, not good individuals when he ends up compromising the ideals for the sake of self-gratification.
Couldn't have said it any better. Are there any closing thoughts by you on this whole Feast for Crows topic?
I'll say that if you didn't like Feast for Crows, give it another read with those things in mind. Look for the internal victories, look for the small things, the triumph of ideals over self-gratification, and I think you'll enjoy it a little bit better.
I can really only re-emphasize that, you know, read A Feast for Crows, read A Dance with Dragons. They are not as brisk and as suspenseful as the first three novels, but they are a lot more complex and a lot more rewarding, I think. You know, there is more work involved in making them into something worthwhile, but I hope what we just talked about today, you know, I mean, it was 2005 when A Feast for Crows was released. This is 14 years ago, and we still debate the meaning of the title of the book, right? And we can fill an entire podcast about this. So this is definitely something that is exciting. And I hope you will tune in next month for the next podcast. And until then, bye-bye. Thanks, Jo, for listening, as always. And thank you, Jim, for being here and doing this with me.
Oh, it's not a problem. It's always a pleasure to talk about the books, especially with old-time fan favorites, because there's lots to talk about. And even, I mean, I've been doing this, I can't even remember how many years now I've been doing this. And sometimes I feel like I'm repeating myself, but not as often as I would think for as long as I've been doing it.
And with that, bye-bye, until next time.
While you're listening to our track that basically throws you out of the door, one announcement for our friend Amin from the podcast of Ice and Fire. Amin is doing a little survey for all players of the Game of Thrones board game from Fantasy Flight Games. So if you are playing this board game, he would like you very much to go to a thread on Board Game Geek, which I linked in the description, and to fill out a little survey, because he's trying to do a statistic about the Game of Thrones board game. So if you play it, please fill out the survey for Amin from the podcast of Ice and Fire. And if you don't play the board game, give it a try. It's a really good board game. See you next time. Bye.